This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on October 29. Last year, the Texas Tribune published an investigation into the history of the Texas Rangers. The state's premier law enforcement agency was founded in 1823 to carry out a, quote, punitive expedition against a band of Indians, unquote. They were instrumental in driving indigenous people from their homelands in the Cherokee War of 1839 and then battled the Comanches in 1840. Their mission soon evolved into capturing runaway slaves, pursuing them into Mexico if necessary. In 1918, joined by local ranchers and U.S. Army soldiers, the Rangers carried out a massacre of 15 men and boys in Porvenir, seeking revenge for cattle raids that in hindsight proved to be fictitious. Then in the mid-1950s, the dawn of the Civil Rights era, the Texas Rangers were on the front lines of the governor's resistance to a federal court order to desegregate Mansfield High School. Today, community activists are demanding that Texas Rangers' name be stricken from the modern-day Texas Department of Public Safety Investigative Agency, as well as the North Texas Major League Baseball team and college mascots. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Lisa Olson, senior reporter and editor for the Texas Observer. She has an article in the current issue titled Justice for Some. The Texas Rangers are tasked with investigating corruption and crimes by public officials. Those officials are rarely held accountable. We're joined by Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of this program. So glad you could join us, Lisa. It sounds like you're pretty busy. You just published a book?
I did. I have a book called Code of Silence. It's about women who blew the whistle on corruption in the federal judiciary, judges who sexually harassed and even assaulted women, including judges in Texas, and the implications for all of us about how some of these complaints have been covered up over the years. So certainly another public corruption investigation. I seem to be stuck on that topic. It's a book I've been working on for a long time, and I'm excited to be appearing at Bookwoman next week in Austin to talk about it.
Great. We'll have to get our hands on that. Tell us a little about your background.
I've been an investigative reporter for more than two decades, and I have worked in four states, but I've been in Texas since 2003. And I came here to work at the I-Team at the Houston Chronicle. Last couple of years, I've been working at the Observer. And I have a specialty in civil rights and public corruption. And that means I've done a lot of stories about a corrupt congressman, a corrupt federal judge, and lately, you know, about how these systems in Texas kind of fail us, both the one that is supposed to investigate public integrity across our state. And in my book, I look at the secretive federal judicial misconduct reviews and how they fail. So I've been, you know, over the years when I find out things from often from whistleblowers about problems, corruption, or people breaking the law who are public officials, I've been astounded at how often nothing happens. The person is allowed to either quietly resign or essentially people pretend that it did never come up. The whistleblowers are often shunned or they lose their jobs. And I think that, you know, it's really important as a reporter to shine a light on why systems fail, you know, so that when people do come forward, they have more confidence that they will be heard, maybe something will happen. And I think right now in Texas, we have a really terrible problem with the public corruption systems getting weaker and not stronger, and they already weren't strong enough. And that's what this series is about.
Well, tell us a little more about the genesis of this. I followed some of this actually on KXAN here in Austin, and it looks like it was a pretty major undertaking.
Yeah, I spent a long time trying to just get the records. My goal was to try to figure out, okay, we know that in 2015, Governor Perry got angry at the Travis County DA, pushed for dismantling what was then a public integrity unit that had functioned for decades based in Austin, and then said, well, the Rangers can do it better. And I thought, well, after 5 years, shouldn't we know about some sort of successes if the Rangers were doing it better? And all I could think of sort of just in my own memory were failures, were cases I knew they'd investigated where no one had been indicted, or we didn't even know what the outcome of the investigation was. You know, there'd been complaints about Sid Miller, the agriculture commissioner, died quietly, nothing happened. There'd been complaints about the former Speaker of the House, died quietly, nothing happened. There've been several times when the Rangers have investigated allegations related to Attorney General Paxton. Of course, he's under indictment and has been his whole entire time in office for stock-related crimes, but yeah, you know, he's never been convicted. And the other things he's been investigated for, and there have been at least two other complaints that have been made public, you know, we don't know what the outcome of the investigation was. So I wanted to delve into that mystery. What's really going on behind the curtain there? So I requested all of the list, first of all the public integrity investigations and public corruption investigations the Rangers had done, because there's kind of an overlap between those two things. And then I asked for every report in which there had been some sort of public result, whether they'd already released it or they'd had some sort of prosecution, in which case under our Texas Public Information Act, the report would be available. And the results were kind of amazing to me. There was just, you know, very few prosecutions, and almost all the prosecutions there were really of these low-level officials under their public corruption program. The public integrity investigations had resulted in very few prosecutions.
These are the good guys. They're the ones in the white hats, right?
Well, that's what, you know, we like to think, although a lot of people would say, well, the Rangers have their own history. But the idea, I think, was that the Rangers were going to bring more investigative manpower to this issue, and that at least Governor Perry argued, you know, that the Travis County DA shouldn't be able to make the call. But the problem is the new system set up in 2015 said, okay, well, Rangers, you know, can get these complaints from anyone, really. But in order to proceed to open an investigation, a local DA has to say it's okay. So before a Ranger can even investigate a public integrity case, and often the public corruption investigations are also run by the DAs, the DA has an opportunity to veto it. So imagine the scenario when a lot of times these allegations are against some other person who's also a county official or a powerful politician in the DA's home county. You know, so in the case of, you know, the former Speaker of the House, Dennis Bonin, the Brazoria County DA had to decide whether, you know, that should be investigated. She did say it should be investigated. But ultimately, she decided not to present the results to the Rangers investigation to a grand jury. And we know that because she made a public statement about it. But The actual report in that case is not public. And I found an example of a couple of cases where people had complained to the Rangers about DAs. Well, so then what happens with this new system? If the DA or the assistant DA is accused of misconduct and the DA, their boss, says, no, I don't want you to investigate. In the case I was looking at in Nacogdoches, the investigation just didn't go anywhere at all, never even began. Civil rights attorney found an assistant DA at the time, and who's now the elected DA, had prosecuted people, even though at the time he was doing that, he was on probation for his second DUI, and he had been deemed ineligible to practice law by the State Bar of Texas. So during a period he was ineligible to practice law, he prosecuted a couple of dozen people in Nacogdoches, signing off on forms as an assistant prosecuting attorney, never revealing to them that he wasn't a licensed attorney, and never putting any disclosure in his personnel file. But that's a case that was never investigated, I think, because of this preview system we have, where somebody can basically derail a public integrity investigation before it can even begin. Both the DA can do that, and also a ranger supervisor can do that. They can take a look at the complaint before a ranger opens an investigation and say, no, we don't want you to spend your time on that. So there's definitely a lot of politics in these investigations. And these were things that people were worried about when these changes were made in 2015. There was testimony back in 2015 saying, you know, if we get rid of the centralized unit, local DAs are going to have to decide whether to prosecute extremely powerful politicians in their home turf. And that probably is not going to go well. There were predictions like that made by several people. And in fact, that is what seems to have happened.
So in the case in Nacogdoches, it was this attorney, Paul Anderson, that you were working with. There's quite a bit about him in your article.
Yes, Paul Anderson. I was already trying to get these records when I heard about Paul Anderson. At the time, I didn't realize that there was this phenomenon where some complaints, even serious ones, could go uninvestigated entirely if, say, you know, a DA didn't approve or the ranger supervisor didn't want it to go forward. He had all the documents he'd sent to the rangers. He showed me what he'd sent to them. And he also had the ranger's response to him. And I found some other people later who had the same kind of responses where the ranger said, well, you know, we're just not going to investigate this. We don't disagree that something happened here, but we're not going to investigate. And, you know, I had another person send me an email where the ranger said, we're not going to investigate because the DA didn't approve. And it was another case out in North Texas. So that's what got me onto this idea of, isn't it kind of outrageous if, does that mean DAs are essentially immune from any kind of investigation, or their buddies are immune from investigation if they can veto these probes, or their bosses can?
This whole web of authority here is not entirely clear to me. Maybe it's clearer to you now, but, you know, in the history of this office, this corruption unit, Travis County had a central place in all this, right? Ronnie Earle. Absolutely. Going back several years?
Yeah, going back for decades before this, back in like the 70s, the public integrity unit had been in Travis County, and the DA in Travis County, which was for many years Ronnie Earle, had specialized prosecutors that were trained to prosecute crimes that a lot of other prosecutors don't necessarily look at very often. Most of these public corruption crimes are things like official oppression or charges that don't come up against ordinary people. There are people using their office to commit crimes. And so a lot of times, if a public official does something, or even if a jailer does something that's against the law, it'll be charged as official oppression or violation of civil rights of a prisoner or something. And if a prosecutor is not skilled in that kind of prosecution or has never done it before, it can also be a harder case for the prosecutor to handle. So there was a reason there were specialized prosecutors looking into these kind of cases. Some of them involve fraud, some of them involve embezzlement, some of them involve all kinds of deception that aren't the average case that a lot of times smaller DAs handle. But when they were farmed out, when that unit was basically relieved of its authority to review public integrity investigations from around the state, well, then those cases would just come in to whatever DA was in the county where the person who was accused of wrongdoing lived. So if a powerful politician like Ken Paxton from Collin County, well, that, you know, the complaint in that case went to the Collin County DA initially. That was one of the first complaints that came in under this new system. And what happened in that early case, I think, indicated what was going to happen later, which is, you know, the DA sat on that complaint, and that was from Texans for Public Justice, that they had provided the information. DA took no action on the public integrity investigation that was done until actually, I and another reporter, Lauren McGaughey, wrote about the fact that he had a conflict of interest. He was Paxton's investment partner, had been for years. So he recused himself kind of at the last minute before the statute of limitations on those charges was about to run. And at that point, this is kind of crazy, a private attorney went to the grand jury in Collin County, a private attorney named Ty Clevenger, and presented the information to a grand jury himself. That's something you can do in Texas law. Most people don't know how to do it. And that's how a grand jury indicted Ken Paxton on those charges that are still pending 6 years later. The system did not work. The system of having a public integrity complaint sent to a local DA didn't work. The local DA didn't do anything, recused himself very much at the last minute, and only threw what's kind of the equivalent of a, you know, somebody, a quarterback way back in the first yard line throwing a bomb to the other end of the field. Did somebody actually get those charges even reviewed? It was a very last minute, unusual effort that resulted in what is really the only pending high profile prosecution of 5 years of the Rangers having these public integrity investigations.
So this complex web, was that all by design, do you suppose? I mean, or you know, I mean, I was thinking about this morning, and, you know, here we're talking about investigating corruption, and, you know, let's go up a level here. Let's investigate the Texas Rangers themselves. You know, I mean, what's the motivation in all this? Is there money at the center of this? Is this just good old boys protecting one another? Do you have any sense about that?
Well, I mean, I have mixed information there. I interviewed a former Texas Ranger who left, who said, you know, there is politics involved in some of these decisions. He said he was pushed into investigating a legislator who had criticized DPS, and he ended up thinking, after conducting that investigation, that it was retribution for the lawmaker speaking out. And I have, at his request, I haven't identified the lawmaker because the lawmaker was never charged with anything. But you also have, I think, the story that I heard from others, which is that Rangers have done, in fact, really good investigations in some of these other cases, the ones that I didn't get copies of. You know, I mentioned the list of other people who've been investigated who were legislators in the last 5 years. And they've been frustrated that local DAs would not act on the information that they've gotten, that they feel that the DAs, local DAs, have been weak. We have a system where maybe there is a great investigation done, but we can never see it, or a system where an investigation is done because somebody is pissing off DPS. Neither one of those outcomes is good. You know, so I think for different reasons, the system is not working. And a lot of people that I talked to said really putting back some sort of centralized unit that could handle public integrity investigations that are specialized and didn't have those conflicts of interest that many local prosecutors have would be the way to go. But, you know, in other states, that's under the attorney general. In our state, our attorney general has been under investigation since the day he got into office or before for multiple public integrity violations. So who would do that? I don't know. I don't know that the legislature would want to put it back under Travis County, because there were issues about whether Travis County ran it correctly too, as you remember.
Right. Was it Rosemary Lemberg? Was she the successor to Ronnie Earle?
Yes. At the time that the unit was, I mean, the unit still exists and does Travis County cases, but it did cases statewide. And when that part of its duties were defunded, the DA was Rosemary Lemberg, and she had herself been arrested for DUI. You know, Perry had asked her to step down, and she refused. And then there was sort of a feud between the two of them, and she ended up bringing information, or somebody in her office did, to a grand jury saying, you know, that Perry had essentially acted improperly by threatening to cut off funding for the unit, veto funding for the unit, in retribution for her refusing to resign. Mm-hmm. She basically started then investigating the governor, or someone in her office did, for threatening to defund this unit because she refused to resign over her DUI. So there was this feud between the governor and the Travis County DA that resulted the year later in this big change in how these investigations were done. Obviously, that wasn't a good outcome.
You talk about feuds and whatnot. We had just a few weeks ago, we interviewed Dana DeBeauvoir on this show. And before we even got into anything, she immediately launched into her story about Ken Paxton going after her. I don't know if you were familiar with that case. Basically, it was more of the way the presidential election was conducted and the observers for counting the ballots.
Poll watchers, yeah.
It's just amazing to me how the whole structure of law seems to evolve based on individual feuds here. Is this the Texan way? Is this a remnant of the Wild West?
Well, you know, that's the question I kind of have as somebody who's only, you know, been here a mere 18 years. When I got here, I saw that some of the institutions that are charged with sort of upholding Texas ethics laws are pretty weak to begin with. I mean, the Texas Ethics Commission has very little funding and hardly any investigative manpower. That's really one of our big watchdogs over this kind of area of corruption. The Judicial Conduct Commission has a handful of people to look into complaints it gets. You know, so the state already was, you know, we got a D minus in a public integrity or Center for Public Integrity. This is a journalism organization in Washington, D.C. that rated all the states in terms of our institutions. But then you're right, since then, it seems like these institutions have further been weakened because of feuds and also because a lot of people have made allegations about the attorney general, who is supposed to be our chief enforcer in the state. I mean, he's been under investigation over and over for different allegations. I mean, a lot of people talk about the stock case, which is pending, right? Stock-related charges. But, you know, after that, he was accused of taking an illegal gift from a donor for his defense fund. That did not result in any charges, but that was investigated. He's been questioned over his involvement in having stock in another company that supplies dash cams to the state police and to local police, and whether that was improper. Nothing happened. You know, and now we know that a whole bunch of his handpicked deputies have accused him of other both federal and state crimes in a civil suit that's pending, and he's under federal investigation for using his influence to try to kill an investigation of one of his allies, Nate Paul, the developer in Austin. And there's lots of unanswered questions raised in that case. So I think you have this feud, like you said, between Perry and Lemberg that had this unfortunate outcome, I think, for Texans. And then you have a new AG entering who does not inspire confidence in whistleblowers. Whistleblowers do not believe, I think, that the people I interviewed anyway, that, you know, the attorney general is the person who can handle properly public integrity complaints. And his own people say that he fired them because they were trying to blow the whistle in the lawsuit. So it's a crazy situation, I think, for Texans. I think as Texans, we want to know that if there's a serious complaint, it's going to be investigated. It's going to be addressed.
Sure. Well, back on the Rangers, just a couple quotes from your article. When confronted with all this, the quote from the Texas Rangers was simply that the modern day Texas Rangers are comprised of principled men and women of great skill and integrity who are fully committed to the rule of law. So I guess that's the end of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Rangers lately, I mean, there's been several stories that have question whether the Rangers have really been asked to do too much with too little and haven't modernized. And I think it's a very legitimate question. And I asked the former Ranger that question. He said, yes, it's ridiculous. You know, we've been asked to do our regular mission, border security, but then we've been asked to investigate all the in-custody deaths because people were saying, well, local sheriffs should not be investigating their own cases. They were asked a few years ago by the legislature to look at, you know, do more on cold cases and serial killer cases. And then more recently, they were asked to do these public corruption and public integrity. These are all specialized kinds of investigations that take very different sorts of skills. And there really aren't that many Rangers. There's just 100 and some. And actually, the numbers have gone down. So why is it that if Texans really want the Rangers to do this kind of stuff, there isn't better training, funding, and designation of who does what or maybe it's just the question is whether this is even appropriate. You know, this is a lot of mandates on a relatively small organization.
Well, the article really focuses on 560 cases between 2015 and the present. Could you go into those statistics a little? What, 88% resulted in no action at all? Is that correct?
Right. As far as we can tell, 88% resulted in no public action of any kind. There was no disclosure of the report and no charges filed. Many of the other cases involved officials who stole money, used their office to steal money, including people who rigged their water bills so they didn't ever pay the right amount, public officials who embezzled tax money or who forged documents to take money. And, you know, you have some fairly large quantities disappearing from coffers of cities and counties that show up in these reports. You know, you have a former city manager from Freeport who stole over $100,000 in funds, proceeds of a Cheech and Chong concert. And it's notable that these kinds of large scale thefts often took years for someone to notice or detect. And then once the Rangers reported them, when the quantity was large enough, usually a DA would file charges. But say, like in that case, there was a prosecution. The DA did not drop the charges, but the Freeport city manager spent very little time in prison and a judge granted him shock probation. He was out within months. That's something that's given to first-time offenders sometimes. But I would say most people, most ordinary people who steal over $100,000 aren't released within a couple months. Yeah. And he was released over the objection of the DA, who said, I don't think there's any hope he's going to repay these public funds. We don't know what he did with them. So even those big, large-scale embezzlements, which there were several of those, you know, didn't result in significant punishment except in one case. There was one person, it was a former, I think, tax assessor who was still in prison. He was the only one I could find. Other people who had either stolen a lot of money or committed serial fraud were often asked simply to apologize and were given some sort of deferred adjudication or the charges were just dismissed.
We're speaking with Lisa Olson, staff reporter and editor for the Texas Observer, about her recent article titled Justice for Some. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on October 29th. Our guest this evening is Lisa Olson, senior reporter and editor for the Texas Observer. We're discussing her article in the current issue titled Justice for Some, dealing with public officials and accountability. Let's pick up where we left off.
There was a JP who was accused of running a Ponzi scheme out in West Texas, and there's no charges filed against her. She wasn't convicted of anything. I'm sorry. There were some charges. You know, she'd apparently been doing this kind of thing for years. The Rangers report shows, you know, essentially she was keeping court documents in her house, not doing her job, running some sort of, like I said, Ponzi scheme. And we don't really know the dimensions of that because she was never actually convicted. She was finally, after years apparently of doing this, forced to give up her seat as JP. But I mean, that to me was a pretty amazing case because here you had somebody who wasn't even processing the state troopers' traffic cases. Hundreds and hundreds of DPS cases weren't being processed by this JP for years before anyone noticed that something was up. So, you know, I don't think it gives you a lot of confidence that the system will also respond quickly to evidence of what might be very systemic theft or fraud.
You mentioned this woman, but in general, fewer women have been charged, but more of them have been convicted, especially women of color?
Yes. I mean, it was a weird thing because when I looked at the cases where someone was convicted, you know, there were fewer women that had been charged, but the proportion of women who were actually convicted was higher. Proportion of women who appeared to have, you know, confessed what they'd done and accepted time in jail was quite a bit higher. It looked to me, you know, without looking deeper, that you see the phenomenon you see in some other areas where white men tend to lawyer up early. They tend to say, you know, I'm not going to talk. And meanwhile, some of the women, many of whom probably knew some of the rangers, just told them what they'd been doing, said, hey, yes, I did the wrong thing. Here's what I did, turned over the evidence. And so, yeah, you had that result too, which was a little dismaying, is that you had more women compared to the number charged who ended up being convicted than men.
You know, your article is just overwhelming. I mean, the centerfold graphic that they've got there in the Texas Observer, it names about 11 cases. Any of those in particular that you'd like to point out to us? You already talked about Nacogdoches and Freeport. Any others in there?
Yes, Betty Velez was the JP out in West Texas. The only way we know she was running a Ponzi scheme for sure is that the Judicial Conduct Commission forced her to resign. And in its public order in that case, it describes the legal activity she was involved in that she apparently admitted to, but she wasn't convicted of that. The other thing was, you know, the number of prosecutions and the number of cases investigated really varied across the state. There were a lot in Houston and East Texas, as you might imagine. But, you know, along the border, I would have thought there would have been a similar number in the Valley as in West Texas. And in fact, in El Paso, the Rangers just didn't seem to be opening investigations hardly at all into public corruption or public integrity, which was surprising. That case of the JP who didn't do her job and was running a Ponzi scheme for years was one of the few that they did investigate. And ultimately, like I said, she was not convicted. One of the other cases they did investigate involved a woman who had accused a DPS agent in West Texas of wrongdoing. She was a prisoner. Some of these cases involve prisoners who accuse guards or DPS or troopers or others of wrongdoing. And in the end, instead of finding anything wrong with the agent, they thought she was lying and they prosecuted her for filing a false report or for perjury. I can't remember which. So she was one of the women of color who ended up spending time in jail over a public integrity complaint. And she was the person who initially tried to blow the whistle. So that was a kind of bizarre outcome, I thought. You have several times a case of a county assessor or tax collector stealing money. And I think that raises the question of whether counties across Texas have ample assistance in, you know, making sure that their funds are audited, because, you know, obviously tax assessor collectors have access to a lot of money. So one of those people who took money, she's on the list there, she was prosecuted. And in that case, she was an older woman and there was sympathy for her. And the DA said, you know, I am not going to back down from this case because I think that when a public servant violates the law and violates public trust, they should be held accountable. It's important that they be held accountable. He refused to back down and agree to dismiss the charges. And he also required her to provide a public letter of apology that he posted on his website. So that was a DA that was swimming upstream. And that was one of the few examples of something like that. And I thought, you know, that stood out among those cases. Like I said, there's a good 20 cases or so where you see public servants being accused of stealing substantial amounts of money. And that was one of the few where, like I said, there's one person in prison still. And then there was one woman who was forced to publicly apologize. Those were two cases where the DAs insisted that public officials be held accountable. But both of the people held accountable in those cases were public servants of color. One was a Hispanic male and one was a Hispanic woman. And like I said, the white man, the Freeport city manager who took probably more than anybody else based on the records the Rangers provided, or at least an equal sum to the man who's in prison, I believe, walked after a few months. He was let out.
Do you have any sense about how Texas compares with other states? Proportionately, is Texas, are we right up there with Louisiana, or is this just to be expected in a state this size?
You know, there are groups that give states grades for their ethics and accountability laws and their institutions. I'd have to look up to see what the latest one is. In my article, I wrote about how, again, the Center for Public Integrity gave Texas a D- 5 years ago before they defunded the Public Integrity Unit. There are plenty of other states that have stronger statutes than we do. One of the things that several DAs and some of the other officials I talked to about this said is that Texas has particularly weak laws, for example, on gifts to public servants. That statute is, first of all, it's hard to prove that there's a violation. And if you do prove it, it tends to be a misdemeanor. Official oppression is often a misdemeanor. You know, some of the other charges that are brought that are complicated to prove and seem serious are misdemeanors in Texas. That also, I think, is a disincentive to the DAs to spend the time on those cases because they know at the end of the day, the person's at most going to pay a small fine or spend a few days in county jail. But these sorts of problems, you know, if they're not addressed, the same person often will go on and do the same thing somewhere else. Not too long ago, the Dallas Morning News had a piece on one of the people who had been fired from a small police department and ended up in Hearn, Texas. There's a big public integrity investigation in Hearn, Texas, in the documents I got that showed that that same guy was not only sexually harassing people in his new job, which is what he'd been fired for in his old job, but he and the police chief appeared to have been not properly handling evidence, shall we say. You know, there seemed to be a lot of items missing or not cataloged, drugs, guns, other things, and a long-term pattern of what appeared to be illegal behavior. Again, the Texas Rangers investigation quite damning there, and there had been previously, you know, an ACLU lawsuit in Hearn about similar problems with the police. Again, nothing happened, you know, no criminal charges against any of those officers. So a lot of times I think if corruption is not addressed, sometimes what will happen is a city will quietly ask somebody to resign. They'll go on to some other town and do the same thing. If corruption isn't addressed one place, a lot of times it ends up being exported.
You know, so much of what you're describing here really sounds structural, you know, or systemic. Do you have any sense about what should be happening here? I mean, should this be moved out of DPS entirely and, you know, moved into a separate judicial organization? Is it just a matter of staffing, or what do you think it would take to clean this up?
What I spoke to other people about was that, you know, reforming a specialized prosecution unit to work with the specialized Rangers Public Integrity Unit would be helpful, whether that was under the AG's office or whether that was an independent office, it would be a big help. So that if something got blocked by a local DA or there was a conflict of interest, there'd be someone who could take over that investigation and proceed. Certainly, there's lots of people who've said that the Texas public ethics laws should be reviewed, including Governor Abbott has said, you know, that some of these laws are inadequate. The legislature never seems to be able to do anything about that. I think reforming a centralized public integrity sort of prosecution unit of some sort would probably help. And that is something other states do have. I think beefing up and continuing to train rangers and specifically these kinds of investigations and looking at whether it's proper for DAs to have this sort of veto authority without any real right of review in public integrity investigations in the meantime would be important. You know, corruption benefits from institutions not doing the right thing. And unfortunately, politicians who violate the law appear to have friends in high places. But I think that all Texans have a stake in this and that, you know, these things should be fixed. Whether they will, I don't know. Every time the ethics conversations come up, they seem to be diverted to something else. And even though, you know, there is often a consensus, you know, we don't get to move forward. And I think, you know, right now, you know, certainly you've seen legislators this last very long session questioning the attorney general on his own spending, you know, because attorney generals lost some of the confidence of some of the legislators about how he's spending his money. And of course, he's supposed to be, again, one of the watchdog agencies. You know, he's supposed to be the counsel for the Texas Ethics Commission. He's supposed to be, his office does sometimes pick up on these cases if they're bobbled locally. In fact, Polly Anderson in Nacogdoches has heard from the Office of the Attorney General, and it's possible that the AG will investigate his complaint. But yeah, there's certainly an issue there. And I think, you know, the other candidates for attorney general have raised issues about whether or not people have confidence in Attorney General Paxton to address these kinds of crimes in Texas when there's been so many allegations against him personally, both by other people and by his own staff, former staff.
Yeah. I'll note that it is unfortunate Jim couldn't join back in here, but he's part of a group that's actually working to disbar Ken Paxton right now. So
yeah. And that's what I was hoping he would come back in to talk about. Certainly, there have been other people who filed bar complaints against Attorney General Paxton. But I mean, the idea that not only is our system dysfunctional in terms of what I was talking to you about, in terms of the investigations of the complaints and the results and the screening and the conflicts of interest, but that even when someone like the attorney general is indicted, that we can't seem to manage to get justice in a timely fashion. We can't get either the charges heard or dismissed.
Yeah.
You know, it just puts a big cloud over the entire office. And the bar complaint relates to, you know, that essentially there's been, again, continual questions about both whether Attorney General Paxton has violated Texas laws and also whether he has used the power of his office to do things that were inappropriate. And that's what the bar complaint relates to. And the open question is, though, clearly the Collin County court system can't seem to deal with criminal allegations against the DA. It appears that the federal agents are struggling with dealing with the new allegations. At least they haven't taken any action yet. And now, you know, there's a question about, is the Texas state bar going to jump into the void and do something against a man that no one else will seem to take any action against? The question is, are any of our institutions strong enough to take on any powerful politician? I mean, certainly we've had in the past powerful politicians charged with crimes. You know, we had Tom DeLay, we had Kay Bailey Hutchison. Tom DeLay was convicted, but on appeal that was overturned. Kay Bailey Hutchison was not convicted. We've had others. You know, we've had former members of the legislature convicted. We've had both by state and federal prosecutions. We also had at one time Dan Morales, a former attorney general, convicted of a crime. That did not take 6 years. So I think there's no question that our systems are really challenged right now. They don't seem to be working. The system of justice, the systems that are in place to try to safeguard us against unethical and unlawful behavior, don't seem to be working for public officials.
Once again, could you tell us the name of your book?
Yes. My book is called Code of Silence, and it's about federal judges, women who blew the whistle, and the secret system that protects those judges. And I am going to be speaking at Woman Bookstore on a virtual event in Austin, Thursday, November 4th at 7 p.m. So you can sign up online if you're interested in hearing more about that.
And are you working on anything else these days for The Observer?
Well, some of my colleagues at The Observer are working on a piece that's going to come out soon about the Rangers investigations of in-custody deaths. So stay tuned. You'll be hearing more about that soon.
Great. Well, we really appreciate you joining us this evening. It was an amazing article. Again, that was Justice for Some in the September-October issue of the Texas Observer. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Well, it's Saturday morning, October 30th, and once again, we have Austin Sanders with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Good morning, Austin.
Good morning, Bob.
By the time this airs, the polling places will have just about shut down. So there's not a whole lot of light that we can give to potential voters here, but maybe some retrospective thoughts about Prop A?
Yeah, sure. I wanted to start with just kind of the early voting totals, which, you know, have been low, which is, I guess, predictable for a mostly local election with some statewide ballot measures as well. When we're talking about the election here, Prop A is kind of the big draw on our ballot. There's, you know, two local propositions, some state constitutional amendments, but there's no candidates, no personalities to kind of draw out more voters. So the turnout predictably has been pretty low for registered voters. At the end of Friday, October 29th, which was the last day of the 12-day early voting period, we were at about 11.8% turnout, which translates to about 100,000 early voters. And well, there's going to be one more day of voting on November 2nd, Election Day. We can kind of expect to see maybe ending up at around 14-15% of registered voters in Travis County, which is a pretty small turnout, right? Especially considering Prop A, the impact that this unfunded mandate for the police department would have. You know, we're talking probably around $100 million annual investment within the police department, maybe more, maybe a little less, but somewhere around there, being decided by somewhere around 11% of voters in the county.
And I can't help but think that this was all by design of the folks who put this on the ballot. That's an editorial comment, okay?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems to be part of the strategy. They kind of did the same thing with Proposition B in May, another off-year, typically low turnout election cycle. And of course, they ended up winning that election by about 20 points. I think there's some notable differences between the Prop A election in this cycle and then Prop B. Again, that's the reinstatement of the public camping ban that Save Austin Now petitioned for, campaigned on, and won in May earlier this year. In the Prop A election, which again is to increase police staffing, mandate this kind of uncommitted time, kind of community policing time, stuff like that. A couple of big differences. One is the opposition to Save Austin Now, the No Way on A campaign, as they have kind of labeled themselves, has been much more robust. They got to work a lot earlier. And they seem to have more campaign staff, bringing in more money to kind of fund the campaign, and seem to be putting up a much more robust communication campaign to kind of inform voters of what this proposition would do. And I think importantly, what it wouldn't do, because as we've talked about before, the ballot language indicates it'll do things like increase police transparency or increase police accountability. But there really are not any measures in the proposition that would actually do those things. You could maybe stretch really far and construe some of the ordinance language to do some of that, but nothing that most people would consider police transparency or accountability. So in the most recent campaign finance report period we have, which is 8 days before the election, so it covers roughly from September 24th through October 23rd, both campaigns had raised over $1 million. Equity PAC, which is kind of representing the No Way on A campaign, the opposition to Prop A, they pulled in $1.06 million. Save Austin Now won three. So Equity PAC kind of had the edge there. And it's been kind of widely reported already. Most of that from the Equity PAC came from the Open Society Policy Center, right? Which is this nonprofit founded by George Soros, the billionaire philanthropist and activist who has contributed to progressive causes and campaigns around the country, including to Jose Garza, now the Travis County District Attorney. Equity PAC had received $500,000 from the Open Society Policy Center. So nearly half of their fundraising has come from this one source. The Fairness Project, which is another kind of national nonprofit that supports progressive local and state ballot measures, they contributed $200,000 earlier in the cycle. AFSCME, which represents civilian employees in Austin, they've contributed $25,000, as well as really being an integral part of the campaign to get out the vote effort. And there's some notable contributions to Save Austin Now.
I read about John Mackey, for example.
John Mackey, yeah, the CEO of Whole Foods. He's infamously a libertarian, ideologue who, you know, really espouses this kind of low government worldview, which is really interesting that he would support through a $10,000 personal contribution to the Save Austin Now campaign, support what is basically an unfunded government mandate. And by that, what we mean is it would mandate the city government spend in the millions of dollars without any source of how to pay it. And the likely ways to pay it are, or really the only two options to pay for that mandate are raising taxes, which again is very counter to the libertarian ideology, or cutting other services, which would probably fit in with the libertarian ideology. But I don't think most libertarians would say cut government spending to invest in the police department, right? And in fact, the Travis County Libertarian Party has voted to oppose Prop A. So Mackey is really not in line with his political ideological counterparts here.
Interesting. I'm trying to think of other impacts this may have. Some of it's got to be the morale of liberal Austin, as it were.
Right.
Having the Republican Party come in these low turnout elections and snipe away at Austin government as we know it.
Right. You know, I had a conversation with Chaz Moore, co-founder, executive director of the Austin Justice Coalition, kind of about this very topic. And, you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but the way he put it was, if Prop A passes, it's kind of a rejection of the work he's been committed to at AJC for the past 6 or 7 years, right? You know, they were moving toward a de-policing, decarceral politics well before the culture kind of broadly caught up with that. And so that's kind of been their goal. And if the city passes this measure, which would really put a dent in that work that AJC is engaged in, yeah, it would really send a message. He kind of said that he would have to, as an organization, AJC would have to kind of reprioritize to say, maybe we were not really as far along in achieving, you know, racial justice as we previously thought. We need to rethink our approach, reconsider what our role and what our mission is in a community that supports an unfunded mandate to, you know, pretty drastically expand the size of the police department.
I think there's two litmus tests here. The first will be, did the opposition to Prop A turn out the vote? Did they get the voters out for this? You know, the other thing, it seems to me, is messaging. You still occasionally hear defund the police, which doesn't settle very well with a lot of people.
Right.
I've heard people from the far left use expressions like abolish the police, which just sends a lot of centrists running for cover, you know?
Right. That has really not been a focus of the No Way on A messaging, probably for the very reasons you've described, right? Their message has very much been, let's protect parks and libraries, EMS and fire, because their argument is, if this passes, there's a very good chance that the way we pay for it is by cutting services like parks, libraries, fire, EMS, you know, by reducing the amount of employees they get, the amount of equipment, the amount of programming they can offer to fund this. So that's really been the focus of their campaign messaging, which I would imagine has something to do with what you've described, that there has been kind of a rejection of defund the police as a slogan by kind of mainstream voters, even though I would attribute most of that is really a kind of misunderstanding of what it means to defund the police, right? Certainly there are some advocates and activists that would like to abolish police departments, like you mentioned. I think there are many others who understand that law enforcement plays a critical role in public safety, but perhaps an outsized role, and it can be shrunken to allow for investment in other mental health services, harm reduction, public health measures, things of that nature. I think definitely we've seen different messaging in this campaign, which we'll see how that translates to votes Tuesday at 7 o'clock.
Well, just one last footnote to this was the incident down in Circle C a few days ago, where it started off with code enforcement at the front door and ended up with the SWAT team there and the owner dead at the hospital. Reading one of the reports, it talked about the SWAT team trying to de-escalate the situation. I just thought, man, is this a euphemism or what? You know, I mean, sending in the SWAT team to de-escalate the situation.
You know? Right. A real tragic outcome there.
Exactly. I don't want to second guess anybody here. Maybe that was all called for. But geez, I mean, how many times have we seen situations here where APD has just lost control and people have died, you know, because of a mental health situation that maybe could have been handled differently?
Right, right.
Well, I really appreciate your analysis here today. As this airs Tuesday evening, we'll all be glued to our TV sets to watch for the outcome of Prop A.
Yeah, I certainly will be. I'm sure I'll be on next week to talk about the results and what it means for our local politics going forward.
Exactly. Thanks so much for your time, and we'll talk to you next week, okay?
Thanks. I appreciate it, Bob.
Up next here on co-op.org and on the 91.7 HD3 channel, stay tuned for Youth Spin. And that's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone.